Hello there, and welcome to the podcast. It's John Markar here, and I thought I'd just jump in with a very quick but very important message that I wanted to share with you before you delve into this episode of the Driven Chat podcast. This podcast, the Driven Chat podcast, has now come to an end. But don't worry, I'm not going to stop you from listening to this episode or from catching up with the 185 episodes that we've recorded in this format. I just wanted to let you know that if you're looking for our new episodes recorded after December 2023, then you'll need to seek out our new podcast, The Driven Podcast. You can find The Driven Podcast in all the usual podcast platforms, including, chances are, the one that you're listening to this one on right now. So please do enjoy this episode, share it with a friend by all means. But when it's done, don't forget to search for the new podcast, The Driven Podcast, and subscribe to the new format to hear the new stuff. To make life easy, head on over to the Driven website via driven.site. There you will find links through to the new podcast, including links to your preferred podcast platform. And hey, whilst you're there, why not check out everything else we do, including hand-picked automotive news stories, car and bike reviews, video features, and even more. For now, though, I'll let you enjoy this episode, and I will remind you again at the end of the episode, but for the future reference, this message is approximately 1 minute and 30 seconds long. That's 6 clicks on the 15-second skip button. Enjoy!
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm Max Gerardo. I am certainly a car enthusiast and lucky to also be in the car world, car dealer, although I don't like to say dealer, but car dealer, and generally love cars. My wife always says to me, how can you work with cars all week and then on weekends you watch racing? What's wrong with you? So that gives you a summary of who I am.
The Driven Chat Podcast, powered by Paramex Digital.
Hello there, and welcome to this week's Driven Chat Podcast. My name is John Markar, and sat beside me is...
It's Miles Lacey. I'm here again. I've not been sacked just yet.
I like that every episode you start with this assumption that maybe
I don't like
you
to
might
assume
not
anything.
Be here.
I don't like to assume anything, but assuming that I could be kicked off the team is a strong assumption.
It's all right. We're all waiting for this weird fantasy world to crumble. Yep. It's just how we all live our lives, isn't it? Max Gerardo, welcome to the Driven Chat Podcast.
Well, thank you very much. Quite excited, quite looking forward to it. We made it.
We had a few
change of dates, but we made it.
We did.
And can I start by saying, ciao Max, piacere.
Oh, che bravo. Parla anche italiano. Ma che bravo.
Grazie. Go on, Miles, carry on.
I was going to say, has he been practicing that all week?
Can you tell I've been practicing that all the way here?
Is that why you've got Duolingo?
I love Duolingo. It's great. I started Duolingo this week, just in case you didn't notice.
I thought we were going to do a full podcast in Italian.
Maybe next time.
Shall we? Do you want to do French instead? Is that easier for you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Actually, French.
On peut commencer en français, si tu veux.
Anyway, I'm just going to show myself the door.
Yeah, it's worth mentioning, actually. We arrived this morning. We're going to set the scene of where we are. We are at Gerardo and Co, which happens to be your home, but also where your business is based. We've been into what was affectionately described by Alex over there, who's sitting silently in the corner, as the cattle shed, which is definitely not full of cattle anymore. It's full of some of the most incredible road cars and racing cars we've ever seen. But yeah, a truly beautiful place. But whilst we were in there, just having a quick look around, I saw that, I don't know if it was a customer or a prospective that was there on FaceTime to somebody speaking French, just handed you the phone and you just cracked on in French. I was very impressed.
I'd say that's one of the great sort of advantages in our world is that, I'm lucky enough to speak four languages.
Perfect.
I wish I could say that, you know, it was all through my hard work. I was just lucky to grow up in the right country at the right time, learning the right language. And you know, it's been great. Like, I'm lucky I can speak to people from all over the world.
Perfect. Yeah, really cool. Well, I definitely want to explore those early stages and ultimately what's got you to where you are now. So a good way to start is one of our favourite questions we like to ask is, do you have a core memory, something as far back as you can remember? It might be as a small child or as a young adult, but something that might have happened that switched on the light that's ultimately got you to where you are now?
Something that switched on lights. I mean, you know, it definitely comes from my dad. He was always super passionate about cars. And I grew up until I was about 12 or 14 years old in Southeast Asia. So, you know, Thailand, Indonesia, Hong Kong, there isn't very many cars. You know, can you imagine the 80s in Bangkok? It's not like you could go buy an old car. It was like tuk-tuks, really. Mm. So that's quite difficult to get passionate about cars with tuk-tuks.
Yeah.
However, we would come back to Italy. My family's from Italy. We'd come back to Italy every summer, religiously. And this will make you laugh. We had a Fiat Ritmo, which I think in the UK is called a Brava, maybe, in the UK?
Or Bravo.
Oh, Bravo.
Fiat Ritmo.
Slightly bigger Punto.
No, before that. It's got a different name. Estrada, it's called in the
Estrada,
UK.
Estrada, right. It rings a bell.
Does it ring a bell? They've all rusted away. That's why there's none here.
Yes,
anyway, we had the Abarth version.
Oh, 100, wow.
Look at the memories. 130 horsepower. And in Turin, there is one road, and I was about 8 years old, there's one road that's got sort of humps in it. I mean, big, like humps, yeah. Like sort of a overpass. Uh-huh. But the angle of the overpass was quite good. And what got me really started is my dad flooring it, 130 horsepower in a hot hatch. Flooring it is all relative. And going over these two humps in Turin, on the outskirts of Turin. And I thought we would take off. We were obviously not taking off. I was like a little, and you know, I would sort of move off of the seat. But it got me, I was like, this is amazing. Yeah. We need to do more. My dad used to do some rallying, and so I was like, well, tell me more. And that's those big sort of overpasses. That's in a Fiat, well, Ritmo as it was called, but here Strada 130 TC. Just in case you're wondering about the model, that's where it all started. Too much detail?
No. Trust me, there'll be somebody listening that goes, "Oh yes, yes,
perfectly visualizing." And most people go, "Oh what?"
Yeah.
it's such a. I love that you've told that story, though, because I'm sure we can all recall being a very small child and being the back of a car going over a humpback bridge. And it's a feeling that I don't think is easy or as easy to replicate as an adult. Once we get a bit heavier and wider, that weightless feeling of going over a hump, which probably lasted for half a second, but your stomach would lift out of its position and you'd go back down and you'd all have a giggle in the back with your brothers and sisters and be like,
we almost died.
Yes. Well, I can tell you, look, it's I'm trying to pass the passion on to the family. So my son, who's 10 and plays football, I genuinely don't think he actually enjoys it that much. I like sort of make him play just because he should have a sport. Anyway, the only reason why I can get him to go to football on Tuesday evenings is because on the way to football, there is one of those humps over one of the bridges. And so as long as we can try and get as much air, I notice I'm getting more and more brave. So I might have to tone it down now. But yeah, we're starting to get some good speed. I think the next stage is going to have someone on the other side at the end of the lane to make sure no one's coming, and we're really going to go for it.
That's right, yeah. Or a little GoPro by the side of the road to see if you get any air.
So if you read any headlines in the Oxford newspaper, then you know, it's probably not gone too well. Yeah.
Perfect.
That's great.
So, yeah, let's try and paint the picture of where we are, because this is a beautiful setting. As you've alluded to, we're in the gorgeous Oxfordshire countryside on what was, I'm guessing, quite a busy farm once upon a time.
It was, yeah. When we bought it, it was definitely a busy farm. There was definitely a farmer here. There was 50 head of cattle, and they were all sort of out. And to be fair, the guy that we got it from was a great multitasker. 50 head of cattle, and also he was like director of some telecommunications company as well, from like the brain center over there on the other side of the farm. Wow. So it was definitely a working farm.
Amazing.
Pretty smelly.
And you'd never know now, would you? I mean, Miles and I have wandered around. We're currently sat in what was one of the barns, by the looks of things, now a beautiful office. The affectionately named cattle shed that we walked into, full of racing cars. You would never in a million years suspect that there'd been herds of cows in there
doing
what cows do.
It's one of those pleasures where you walk in because you've got no real idea it's here, and then this door opens and it reveals what is there, which is these unicorn cars and an absolutely incredible collection of them together.
Yeah,
well, it's quite nice because you said this was an old barn, and actually there was a manor house just down the road when you turned onto our lane, and called sort of Ascot Park, and it burned down, but this actual building was the sort of the carriage house, was where the manor house used to keep the horses here in this barn. And I guess it was sort of, you know, 200 years ago, the horses were like the cars. So it's quite a nice sort of connection. So
we're in the garage.
We're in the garage. Yeah. We're in the garage. Love there
that.
We go.
I wonder what the equivalent of that period was to a LaFerrari back then.
It was probably a carriage with, like, I would say, like 6 or 8 horses.
Yes.
Pulling it, and a very brave man sitting in the back. If you floor a LaFerrari, you also have to be pretty brave.
Exactly.
Well, on the subject of brave men, I mean, as we arrived this morning, you very successfully have clearly sold a LaFerrari, and we watched the painful task of reversing that onto a trailer, which I don't envy that at all. That's just, I just couldn't possibly do it.
It's even better when you've got an audience of people watching as well.
Filming.
Yeah. Filming. Yeah. And a transport driver going, no, I meant this way. No, left. No, I meant right. Sorry, did I say left or right? And then I got out of the car and he's like, oh, I'm very impressed you followed my instructions. I was like,
so am I.
I can't see out the back.
My favourite thing.
Oh, like a real racing driver. I was like, well, I'm not like a real racing driver.
My favourite thing is, as he was giving the directions, pointing in 2 directions at the same time, he then said, I'm not really paying attention. What am I doing?
Your only job. You're not doing it.
Don't worry. It's almost close to £3 million that we're trying to load onto a trailer.
Wild. You know, what is £3 million amongst friends?
There we go. Yeah.
So let's talk about the cars that you've got here, because we've had a quick look around. We've seen a good selection of cars in the big main room. We've also had a quick look into the unseen section of that room as well, where I know you've got a few cars in there that you own personally. There's a few cars in there that are in storage. But the majority of what's here, is it fair to say this is stock that's for sale?
Yeah. So we very much take the everything that you see in the showroom is for sale. I think that people should come here, and there's no like, oh maybe let me see if I can get it. No, if it's here, it's here because we're representing, either we own it or we're representing the car on behalf of an owner. And so the idea is that, yeah, it's for sale. Apart from, as you said, the back room, if you want to call it, where it's funny. It's like, you know, it's like when you have a dinner party and you have a party, invite everyone to your house, and you say, okay, everyone can be in the living room, and all the buggers want to go into the kitchen. Yep. Why do you want to hang out in the kitchen?
Yeah,
So that back room is like the kitchen. Everyone just wants to, like, can we just go and see what's there? But
yeah.
I spent hours positioning the cars in the showroom. Why do you want to see them on racks? Oh, no, this is the special stuff's in here.
It is. Like forbidden fruit.
It's a nice kitchen, though. Yeah, there we go.
Yeah, no, it is. No, there are some cars in there. I made some notes, so let me know if there's anything I list here, which we definitely can't talk about. But there are a few things that I couldn't help but just make a note of, because they're things I definitely want to talk about. A good solid collection of rally cars in there.
So yeah. Secret. That's our secret pleasure. That's our, what is it? 50 Shades of Red. What is it? The red room, the dark room. What's it called? The safe room. What's it called?
Yeah. The pleasure room.
The pleasure room. Yeah, there we go. The rally cars are in the pleasure room. We don't like to tell anyone about that.
Yeah.
So to list off some of these cars, we've got a Lancia Delta Integrale, which I think Alex pointed out, one of the most successful rally cars ever. Is that?
Yeah, I mean, that Deltona is the only double winner. So you've got to, you know, sort of cast your mind back, early 90s. Works effort from Lancia in the World Rally Championship, and pretty much it would be one or at most 2 races for the car and then build a new one, like new shell, new everything. It was no expense spared. So that car that you saw there is the only double winner in the final year of the Lancia Delta. So it won Finland and Australia with Didier Auriol, who was a world champion in that year.
That's cool.
Really cool.
That's pretty good history on that.
And then there was also, I noticed, a Impreza WRX and a Celica WRX.
Yeah, so there's the Toyota belongs to a really good client of ours who's... So we've got clients from all over the world. So the Toyota, for example, belongs to a really good client of ours in Argentina. It's not so easy to get cars into Argentina, so we have the pleasure of housing it, homing it here. The Subaru, as you probably know, I've got a bit of a soft spot for rally cars and Subarus. I mean, it's just so much. So that's mine. So much fun to drive. Like if all the clients that we've had that I've managed to get into the seat of a Subaru, I'd say everyone's then bought one. It's a great drive, especially if you come from, because we all sort of talk about, you know, circuit cars or supercars or hypercars, and then you get into a world rally car of that era, and I have to say it's something. It just makes you smile. I'm not saying it's necessarily the fastest, or it's very fast and it's in the right conditions, but it just makes you smile. I think it's
everything, isn't it? It's the little noises, it's the little nuances, everything, gearboxes whining, all that kind of thing. It's an entirely different experience to driving a fast road car.
Yeah, exactly right. And the best bit, it's road registered. I mean, they're all road registered, so, you know, we can get in the car now, fire it up, and we'll go to the pub.
Right, and it's got a hydraulic handbrake.
We'll see you there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. For when we get to the pub. Hydraulic handbrake on.
Nothing like parking up in a pub car park sideways with all four wheels locked up. That's what you want. There were two, also in that little secret kitchen pleasure room, two 300 SLs. I noticed one, a convertible with a hard top roof, but the one parked next to it caught my eye because it had that little clue of being quite a special car. The later wheels, the later steering wheel, this is... And correct me if I'm wrong, this 6.3 litre engine kind of like continuation car. I can't remember what Mercedes called them.
So you were doing so well until you got to the end of the bit and you said car. But up to then, I was like, God, this guy's good.
Guy knows.
Like, nobody knows what that is. This is really good. So it's a super, super cool car. And it's actually quite cool to have the original 300 SL Roadster parked there. Like, super rare spec, one of the... So only 38 with Rudge wheels. So I don't know if you had the center lock wheels. It's a really rare, restored by the Mercedes-Benz factory for the current owner. That's a car that's been sold. We're just waiting for it to be ready to be shipped to America. And then next to it, as you saw, is a 300 SL, an original 300 SL, but it's been restored and reimagined.
Mm-hmm.
Is that
for breast? I think so, yeah.
So you got to cast your mind back. So this is the year 2000. The Sultan of Brunei, if you guys remember about the Sultan, he was buying cars left, right, and center. And one of the things he wanted 300 SL Gullwings, but with modern running gear. Mm. So most people would go to a Mercedes specialist or so on, but what the Sultan did is he went to Mercedes-Benz. And Mercedes-Benz, and can you imagine? Mercedes-Benz said, yeah, okay, we'll do it. So they built 10 cars for him.
Wow.
So they are original 300 SLs, Gullwings, original chassis, original body. They've taken all the running gear out, and then they put, that's right, like the Mercedes-Benz 2000 V8 engine, transmission, rear axle, brakes, and then hence you see the bigger wheels, because it's got the bigger brakes. So they had to put bigger wheels.
Yeah.
Completely redid a sort of a modern interior. Right-hand drive. So obviously a 300 SL Gullwing doesn't exist in right-hand drive. And in 2000, so a couple of cool things. First of all, super cool that Mercedes will never, ever, ever do it again. Never, ever do it again. And actually, if you think about it, he was sort of ahead of his time in a way, because now... Singer and Futurista and you know Alphaholics GTA. There's loads of restaurants,
but
he got the Mercedes-Benz factory to do it. They were being built. This is the same year of the CLK GTRs, the road cars, and we've got pictures of that car being built next to one of the CLK, because the CLKs were hand built as well.
Yeah.
Next to the CLK
That's
GTRs.
Unreal. That's unreal.
Mercedes-Benz charged them $1 million for each conversion. He ordered 10, plus. Buying a Gullwing donor car, and this was a time when, if you remember, if you know, there was a point where his brother said, "Whoa! You're spending billions. You spent hundreds of $1 million like a month. Enough. Stop. Shut the tap off. No more. Like you bought Aspreys. You've bought the Dorchester. You're buying all these cars. Enough." So two of these cars never actually got delivered. Because Brunei never paid for them. They stayed. And they got sold then to very good sort of VIP clients of Mercedes-Benz. So they're out in the wild. There's another 8 in Brunei, and there's 2 or 3 we don't really know, because nobody knows exactly how many. It could be 10, could be 11 that were built. So there's 2 or 3 that are out in the wild. And it's really interesting, because it's a polarizing car. Mm. Some people come in and think, oh, how could you ever do that? Some people think, what a cool thing. Like, but he was actually out of his mind, but actually ahead of his time.
I
so that's
the fact
quite cool.
That it's been done by Mercedes as well. You know, that's the difference.
I'll top that. By Mercedes, by AMG. It's all done by AMG. They will never, ever, ever do that for anyone. But they did it for him.
Well, they was my previous line of work. I used to work for Bentley Motors, and their special engineering section was funded for a long time for building cars for the Sultan of Brunei, a bit before my time. Incredible one-offs that they would put all of their time and engineering and their best engineers onto building one or maybe 5 cars just for him.
And is it interesting that sort of back then in 2000, everyone thought he was mad. And now, if you think about it, resto mods are all the rage. One-off cars. Now you can go to Rolls Royce, the swept tail or Ferrari. You can have a tailor-made car. You can have a what they call a one-off program. Actually, it's interesting. Like now wave. The people, the market has kind of followed in his tracks. Yeah. But yeah, so that's a pretty interesting, rare car that you will definitely not, I say definitely, never say never, but unlikely you'll see one again.
It's definitely something I've only ever seen in photographs. And to walk in and see the wheels and then see the steering wheel, it was like, oh, okay, this is the real deal. So yeah, it is. It's a unicorn car. I think that's definitely the right word to use.
Yeah, we're so, quite happy so to have clapped eyes on it. As we look around as well, notice an awful lot of Lancia memorabilia and whatnot around the place.
Yeah, so that's my family's Italian. As Italians, we tend to gravitate towards Italian cars. My dad was a very, very amateur, rally driver. But so growing up, you know, once we went over those humps in the Fiat Ritmo 130 TC, it was sort of rallying was in, I guess, not saying my blood, but I heard all the rally stories, and I sort of learned from my dad, and Lancia for him was like the thing to have. You know, if you grow up in Italy, you don't. No, there's nothing wrong with an RS200 or nothing wrong with an Audi at all. Mm. However, you want an Italian car. So I'd say Lancia is a brand that, it's not particularly in fashion probably, but it is a brand that I quite like.
Yeah, they are really cool. I have a very amazing memory once upon a time, previous life, running car tours all over Europe, and we used to do a lot in Italy, a lot with the Ferrari factory, and talking to one of the engineers from Ferrari who'd been there many, many years. And he said, there are two cars you can drive here, because our group, a load of Brits that had brought their cars over for this road trip, had a collection of all different brands, and people from the factory would come out and have a look and go, oh, Aston Martin, Lamborghini, Mercedes, isn't it? Ah, well, Ferrari here and Ferrari here, right? Those are important. And talking to one of the engineers, he said, there are only two makes of car that you could quite happily crash through a school playground in and nobody would even bat an eye. He said, the first is a Ferrari of any variety and the second is a Lancia rally car. And I went, okay, well, I'm not going to test that. It's a pretty bold claim.
Feel like doing that, though, then.
Yeah, absolutely. You'll make the headlines if you're in anything other than a Ferrari and a Lancia. Otherwise, it's just an accident. These things happen. Also in that little room, and we'll step out, there are two other cars that I want to mention in that room. Firstly, a glorious Ferrari Daytona, which, again, the story of this blew my mind, so do fill in any gaps you can here, but a one-owner car with only, I think, 7,000 miles.
Yeah, isn't that unbelievable? So ordered by a family that's based in Wales, ordered by them through to from Maranello Concessionaires, but specified in left-hand drive, because they had a house in Tuscany. And so the idea was that the Daytona was bought in the UK, because that's where they lived, but ordered in left-hand drive to drive back and forth, or keep at the house in Tuscany, and they've owned it since new. So early plexiglass version, good color, silver with black, which is nice. It's not red, and it's been in their collection or in their garage ever since new. Isn't that amazing?
It's amazing, and I'm guessing it didn't do many of those trips back and forth to Tuscany.
Well, no, exactly. Yeah, exactly right. I guess it went to Tuscany once and then stayed there, and they didn't use it very much, or it didn't do very much going back and back and forth. They probably got scared with seeing the fuel bills. I drove it to Tuscany once. I thought, Jesus, how much can it? Yeah. How much fuel does this thing drink? Yeah,
yeah. Or a bit of arm pump, because they're a bit physical to drive.
They are. Yeah, they are.
Not good for people with tennis elbow, or is it squash elbow?
That's not a good car. Yeah. The less said about that, the better.
The last car that I want to talk about in that room, which is probably then also going to unlock by proxy a few other memories and some stories we want to delve into, is a rather special Alfa Romeo that was parked up in the corner there. It's the SZ, affectionately named Il Monstro.
Yeah.
Because, of course, it's one of those cars that some people look at and see beauty, and others look at and go, ooh, that's a different looking car. But that is a car with a particularly good story, and I'm going to let you take the lead on why the story is so good with that particular car.
Is that why you're so polite about it when you said some people think, oh, that's an interesting looking car?
Oh, you actually truth, like it. Yeah.
The truth is that people say, God, it's ugly. What happened there?
I genuinely love them. I think they are I'm not going to call it a pretty car, because it's not a pretty car, but there's just something about it. It looks so unique, doesn't it? That bank of headlights at the front, three lights on either side, that flat squared back at the end. It's so kind of like brutalist. It's an amazing looking thing. But yes, tell us the story of that car, because
is really special. So, well, let me tell you the second half first, then I'll tell you the first half. So I was coming back from Spa with a friend of mine. I like to make it sound super glamorous, but I was actually doing the Fun Cup 25 hours in the Volkswagen Beetles. If I should have said I was doing like Nürburgring 24, and I was in a GT3 Works BMW. Anyway, driving back,
I think
from
people would be more excited about the Fun Cup.
Ooh, yeah, 25 hours in the Fun Cup. The only, just a small parenthesis, the only race I've ever done where you come out of your stint, come out of and the team has a keg there, and every time you get out of the car, they hand you a beer.
Love that.
This is great. This is great. And then you go for a massage. I was coming back from Spa with some friends, and Matt, one of my really good friends, is like, "Oh, you know, your birthday's coming up. What do you want for your birthday?" And I was like, "I don't." He didn't buy my car. Don't want anything for my birthday. He's like, "Oh, you're such a pain. You never say. Always say. You always like, you know, whatever you want. You always get yourself all the things. What am I gonna get you?" And I said, "Tell you what, Matt. Tell you what, something for my birthday." Because I was looking through some old pictures. I said, "My dad had an Alfa Romeo SZ, and I remember, you know, when I was 17 years old, going with him to the dealership, to the Alfa Romeo dealership, and you know, it was. We went to look at the Alfa Romeo SZ, and you couldn't. There was one there in the dealership. You couldn't buy one at the time. They were all supposed to be all sold. 1989. You know, this was the hype. And then after that, we went to the Porsche dealership. You know, and was he going to buy a 911? This is like his like big purchase to buy a new car, 911 Turbo. What do we get? And then after a lot of debating, actually wasn't that much debating, he's like, "Right, let's try and buy the SZ." And the dealer did such a good job on my dad. I mean, so good. He's like, "Oh, they're all sold, impossible to get one." I mean, however, for a small premium, you can go. So I remember we went back with a brown envelope. I was living in Switzerland, in Geneva at the time, with 10,000 Swiss francs.
Wow.
It was 100,000 Swiss francs to buy the car. And there was 10,000 Swiss francs in a brown envelope. Handed it over, and he bought the car. And then you know, sort of lost track of the car. So I said to Matt, I said, "You know, why do you find my dad's old SZ?" Thinking,
wow,
impossible.
Yeah.
Like, how are you going to find, like, there's 1,000 cars. You know, I know the number. It's number 949. So about 18 months later, he called me up and he's like, "Dude." I was like, "What's up, Matt?" "Found the car."
"No."
I was like, "No way." "Yeah, I found the car. It's in Holland. Here it is." So he sends me the phone number, and I called the guy. I was like, "Really? Like, that's..." And it turned out that it was chassis number ended up in 949, but not actually the car number. So I was like, "Oh, Jesus." I was actually quite excited. Anyway, a year goes by again. Lost hope. And 2.5 years later, he calls me up. He's like, "This time, I've really found the car. Car number 949, not the chassis number that ends in 949. I was like, no way. He's like, "I promise you, here's the pictures, here's the car." I was like, "Where is it?" So it's in Germany. So I called up it was with an Alfa Romeo dealer. He had owned it for like 10 years, and it was actually not for sale. It was, he found it on some forum or some meeting. So I explained to him the story. I was like, "Look, it was my dad's car." And being a good sort of German dealer, he probably thought, not for sale, yeah? You know, this is my favorite.
For a little, you know.
but it was great, and I said, you know, I managed to agree that he would sell me the car, and I bought it, and I called my friend Matt, and I was like, "Can't thank you enough. That's the most expensive birthday present I've ever had." Yeah. He found me a phone number and had to go and bloody buy the car. So I bought it back, and so it was my dad's car. I've got pictures of me with that car when we collected it, when I was didn't even have a driving license. I remember driving it with no driving license. And what makes it even more special, or not even more special, also just as special, is that let me think, so 1997. So we bought it in 89. In 1997, about 10 years later, we had it. He did about... barely ever drove it, like, so silly. Now, if I could change things now, we should have driven a lot more. Anyway, 2,000 miles, and I just got a job at Brooks, which now has become Bonhams, so the auction house.
Of course, yeah.
My first job ever. I was 19 years old. I got sandwiches, but I was also supposed to find cars for the auctions. And I came home, I was like, "Dad, my job's not going well. I can't find any cars. I don't really, like, you know." Wow. And he's like, "Look, I'm going to sell the SZ. Like, I don't really use it. Why don't you consign that to the auction and to the Nürburgring auction and sell that. That'll get you started." So which I did. It sold Klaus Kleofas, I'll never forget, at the Nürburgring auction for 50,000 Deutschmarks. We paid 100,000 Swiss francs. He did about 2,000 miles in it. Worst investment ever.
Yeah.
Now they bought it back for almost list price, like almost 100,000 Swiss francs now with 56,000 kilometers. So just goes to show, get out and drive your cars.
Yeah.
Yes.
But yeah, so I don't think it gets, for me, it's probably the most special cars. I remember my dad buying a new, I was with him. We had it brand new. It's the first car that I ever sold. I mean, I'm talking bar, not even like my own personal car. I can't even say, oh yeah, I had a, no, that's like the first car I ever sold. So it got started me in this huge career, this passion for cars, and now I was able to buy back and like to take, you know, my son or my daughter out in the car and say to him, like, explain, like, you know, I mean, he probably's like, what?
Yeah, what is
but
this?
However, for me,
it's like a monster.
Yeah. For me, it's hugely special. And you know, people always say, like, you know, what's your favorite car? I don't know. Depends which day you ask me. Or, you know, which one would you never sell? And I gotta say, like, that one. Well, I've got a small list of ones I've never sold, but that one's definitely like up there in, you know, pole position, the top. It doesn't get more special. And then I was last summer. I was in Geneva with my. At my family's home, and I found, like, so terrible, was it? Found the original car cover. Very exciting.
Really?
yeah. Which obviously didn't get delivered with the car. Found, like, he had bought all these SZ books or Alfa Romeo books. Oh, wow. And found all those. So anyway, a bit sad. But I definitely very special thing to me. And I drive it now.
Yeah.
Got to drive them.
Right? That is such an amazing story, because I think we can all think of parents' cars. You know, so many of us have grown up, and sometimes, you know, not as, perhaps as special as an SZ, or, you know, for me, it's a chocolate brown Ford Cortina, which is about as unexciting as it gets. But yeah, very romantic memories of a chocolate brown Cortina growing up. And the idea that you might be able to someday find that car again, mm-hmm. It's such a wonderful thing.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
It's, a dream for many.
So, Max, tell us a little bit about this, where it starts, because you go along, as you say, 19 years old, you go and work for Brooks into this crazy world of car auctions and whatnot, and you've signed your first car. It seems to go right.
Yeah, it seems to go right. I mean, just taking one step back, I was at I was at school. My last school years, I was in Geneva, in Switzerland, and I was finished school, signed up for university. I was going to university, but as a good Italian boy, I was living at home. You know, don't you as Italian? Us Italians, we try not to leave home. I mean, everyone's like, oh, you need to leave home. Why? Like, the fridge is full. My mum does my washing. And it's like, the house is always clean.
Yeah.
Why do I want to leave? Anyway, I got a bit of a... wasn't so keen on the whole studies thing, and I was working in a pub, and I worked one night in a pub, and then two nights in a pub, and then I was like, wow, you can make money. I don't have any rent to pay. And it turned into 5 nights a week in the pub. Pubs in Geneva were closing at 2 o'clock in the morning. In a, needless to say, by the time you clean up, close up, but you get home at 3, you definitely don't go to class at 9. So I wasn't particularly doing very well at university, and... And an ex-girlfriend of mine came into the pub and said, I have some things to tell you. I was like, oh, shit. No, I thought of you the other day, because she saw an ad for something to do with cars, and you love cars. So that's how I applied for a job. It was at Brooks at the time in Geneva. Simon Kidston was the head of the operation, Brooks Europe at the time. And thank God he offered me, I went for a job interview. And I don't know why, but he offered me a job at the time. And I'll never forget going home to my mum, because I was living at home. And I was like, mum, great news. I've been offered a job in the cars. And I'll tell you what, I'm going to work for summer. And I promise you, after summer, I won't go working. I'll stop working in the pub. She might used to drive my mum mad, working in the pub, coming at 3 a.m. Won't go back to the pubs anymore. I'm going to work in this job for summer. I'm going to, you know, get some work experience. And then come September, I'm going to go back and go back to school, go back to university properly and actually finish my degree. Of course, I never did go back to university. I worked there for sort of almost 10 years in Switzerland with Simon. And Simon was great. He like taught me, I have to say, like gave me an opportunity. He taught me, so I'd like to say taught me everything I know, but I can't say that because just in case he listens to this, he might get all excited about it. He taught me a lot. Let's downplay it a little bit, but he was a great mentor. And so it all started in the auction business, which I was very lucky. It's a great place to start, you know, if you want to get into the world of cars, because it gives you such a wide exposure to different cars, different people. There's an auction like every month at the time, every couple of months, so you're always busy and learning a lot. You learn so much because of the variety of cars that you see going through all the time.
Love that.
So that's where it all started. And then sort of 10 years in, I thought, you know, time to maybe move out of my mum's house.
So you're what? Coming up to 30 at this point?
Well, no, it's probably sooner. So I started, Simon gave me my job when I was 19. And I started working at Bonhams, and I was probably 26 or 27. So I guess it is coming up to 30, isn't it? And we had a good, funny, I don't know, he probably remembers it differently to I, but I went to ask for a raise, and he's like, no way, I'm not going to give you a raise. And I was like, and sort of, you know, proud moments of negotiation. Then I got offered a job by Cars UK, it was a shipping logistics company.
Yeah.
I got offered a job by them. You know, they were always trying to come over. And then they made me a really good offer for what I thought at the time was loads of money, go live in Monaco. And so I said to Simon, I was like, you know what? Too little, too late. I've got another job offer. I was like, oh my God, I can't believe I said that. And I went off and I did move to Monaco. South of France, lived there for 3 or 4 years doing logistics of high value cars. I knew all the people, I knew all the cars.
Of course, yeah.
It was great. It seemed at the time like a load of money, and I was living in Monaco. It was great. I had a fantastic time. However, if you're super passionate about cars, you know, I love cars, I love people. And yeah, you get to deal with the people on the shipping side, but it's not the same. You know, finding the cars, putting the deals together. It was amazing. I'm glad that I left at the time, but it wasn't quite like, you know, I wanted to get back into the sales.
It wasn't your calling.
Yeah, wasn't my calling. There we go. And again, Simon comes back into the story. Never forget Retromobile one day in Paris. I bumped into the aisle and he says, yeah, those guys from RM keep trying to hire me. They were trying to hire him to open an office in Europe, open a European operation from RM Auctions. And he's like, I've just come out of the meeting, and good that I see you, because I've told Rob Myers, like, I'm not gonna go work for him, but you do that. You go work for him.
Wow.
I've recommended that they speak to you, work for them for a few years, and then let's go work. Let's come back and work with me. Like, go and learn again, and then I was like, oh, that's a good idea. So that's it. 2007, I think it was 2006. I left the shipping world and got back in the sales into auctions, RM Auctions. Set up the office here in Europe. Went to Canada for 6 months to sort of learn the ropes. Then moved to London and opened the office. And we had our first auction was the Ferrari auction in 2007. Had a London auction, and I stayed there until about 6 or 7 years ago. Just sort of developing the auction calendar. We got Paris, Monaco, Villa d'Este, became head auctioneer there. Mm-hmm. And I loved it. It was amazing. Like, it was a great experience. I'd do it all again. The people, the cars.
Yeah.
It was phenomenal. Absolutely. I learned so much. Phenomenal.
What a path. Yeah.
There we go. And then 6 years ago, I thought, you know what? You only live once. Funny enough, my dad had always said to me, he had 5-6 years ago before that, he had started his own business. He always said to me, like, yeah, I should have done it sooner. And I always thought to myself, do I, don't I, would I like to? RM was amazing, but it was getting so big.
Yeah.
Amazing, like, what an amazing organization. But we were starting to get sort of, you know, we had to like hit numbers and, you know, what are the sales totals? And I love the cars, I like the people. I want to spend time with people and cars. And so my dad unfortunately passed away really suddenly. Like, I used to speak to him every day, spoke to him in the morning, everything was fine. And it just, I thought to myself, you know what? Things like this can happen.
Yeah.
Let's do this. Let's give it a shot.
Yeah.
What's the worst? And there's a friend of mine said to me, there's never a good time. If you want to go out on your own, it's always bad. You just had a kid. You got a mortgage to pay.
Yeah.
But there's one more auction. I could do that.
You could wait forever.
Never, never, never the right time. And I thought, you know what? Let's give it a shot. What's the worst that can happen? I'll have to go and get a job with Simon Kidston again.
Not the worst of all. Right? So you still haven't actually taken him up on that offer, have you?
No.
He's still waiting.
I'm keeping it just in case it all goes wrong.
He's still
keeping it.
He's still sat there by the phone thinking, come on.
I thought he said it was going to be a year. I love the... we'll cut to a short advert break in a second, but I love... There's a certain romance to the idea of working in that world of auctions. And I know that the world has changed dramatically modern day with online auctions and things like collecting cars coming along and shaking up the world. But there is a certain romance to the idea of being... Because I looked into it as well. I remember vividly looking into it at that typical chapter of going, what the hell am I going to do with my life? What do I want to be when I grow up? Still don't necessarily know. But there was a certain romance with the idea of working in the world of car auctions and the cars themselves being exciting, but also hearing those stories. When you're consigning a car, especially something a bit special, hearing those stories, like the story of the SZ. You know, it's they all mean something, and there might be a car that's not particularly special, but the story that comes with it is just
You know what? You're absolutely right, and I was super lucky. You know, I always say, like, you make your own luck. However, you got to get out there and you got to do things, and you know. But I was very lucky to be in the auction world at the right time. The market was on fire. It was great. There was no online auctions, you know, and I was the auctioneer, which was amazing, because I love auctioneering. That's one thing I do miss. Like, actually getting up there in the gavel with the gavel was phenomenal. So I was really, really lucky, and one of my best memories is actually from auctioneer cars. I don't have to pretend that it was here, but just one of the things that, you know, it was auctioning a 275 Nart Spider. It came from a single owner who passed away, and the family was selling it. The guy that had bought it was an orphan, a self-made man, but an orphan. And they were donating all the money at the time to orphanages. Mm. That was their, like, dad's passed away. He was an orphan. He got a chance because he had someone get, we're going to sell the car. They were expecting, you know, $15 to $18 million at the time. This is Monterey auction. And the car comes up. There's the whole family, second row. They're all watching me. It's all going to charity. I'm like, it's almost more pressure. Like, you know, and they're expecting $15 million. And the auction starts, and it was like 5, and then 10, and then 12, and then 13, and then 14, and then $1 million increments, 15, 16, 17, what? 20, 22, 24, until it sold for $25 million.
Come on.
And I looked up, and it's going to sound, this is going to sound really corny. I looked up, and like, they were literally, all six of them, the family, they were all in tears.
Wow.
And I looked up and I was like, oh my God, I'm going to start laughing up as well. I'm in front of 500 people here. But how is that? Like, one owner.
That's
and amazing. Incredible. What a... But I was there. Look, the market was right. It was the right time to sell it.
What a great
memory.
It was all down to the auctioneer. Definitely. It's an art, isn't it? In captivating that room. And I love attending auctions. I know in this modern world, it's so easy to sell a car online or you know, you consign the car to somebody, make it go away. But there is something so magical still to this day about standing in an auction room. And we've talked about it, Miles and I, in the times that we've been at the Goodwood Revival. And if Bonhams have got the auction happening on the Saturday, it's like, right, actually, let's just dive over there. And even if you're in there for half an hour, just to watch a couple of cars go through.
Great fun, isn't it?
That circus, that atmosphere of people getting excited, you know, reading the room, glancing over shoulders. There's nothing else like it in terms of
Subarus, actually, that when we were at that auction, at the last revival, or no, it may have been members meeting. When they had the Subaru there, the tarmac car.
Yeah.
We'd shot a film for that car.
Yes.
And I was just there just to see how it went. And I was, as it was going under the hammer, I took a picture of it like this with my phone. And then someone went, put your hand up. So I very accidentally nearly bought a priceless Subaru World Rally car.
Would have been a good purchase.
It would have been great, yeah. I mean, jokes would have been on them when they went, so where's the cash?
And how are we hoping to pay?
Yes.
Yes. Let's cut to a quick advert break. We will give our memory card a chance to cool down. And then when we come back, I want to explore this new chapter, because I think it's really exciting to learn how you go from working for the man, shall we say, whether his name's Simon or not, to then being the man with your own business. We'll be back in just a second.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The Driven Chat Podcast.
and we are back in the room, which is nice. We just had a nice chat, actually, off mic, which is annoying when this happens because we end up having these amazing conversations going, oh, God, I should probably be recording this. But there we are. So we were talking about the importance of the Italian heritage, and you explained, so you grew up in...
Well, I actually grew up in so I'll give you the condensed version. So all my family's Italian. Yes. They all live in Turin. They are all in Turin right now. No one ever left Turin. It's about as Italian as it gets. And I was actually born in Australia. Uh-huh. My mother got onto a plane when she was about 7 months pregnant. They almost didn't let her on. Right. She was going to meet my dad, who was there already. So it was definitely a one-way trip. So I was born in Australia. Stayed there for a couple of years. We moved back to Italy for a year or so. Then we moved to Thailand, lived in Bangkok for a couple of years. Then we moved into Indonesia, lived in Jakarta for a couple of years. Then after that, we did Singapore. Then we came back to Italy for a year, then went to Hong Kong. And by this time, I left Hong Kong when I was about 11 years old and moved to Switzerland, to Geneva, where I finished my primary schooling. So actually, yes, I feel Italian. All my family is Italian.
Yeah.
But I'm probably the least, I'm sad to say, I'm probably the least Italian person that that I know. But probably because of that, because I missed out on actually living in Italy.
Yeah.
I'm super keen and quite patriotic about Italy. And as I was saying before, like around here, anything that we can get that's Italian, it'll be Italian.
It's so...
Well, the one thing you definitely didn't disappoint on when we arrived, the first thing we were offered... was a coffee.
There we go. There perfect. We go. Made by an Italian coffee, but not Italian man, but Italian a coffee machine. There was Italian coffee machine.
Yeah. Exactly. It was very authentic.
Mm-hmm. And outside there was a LaFerrari, an Italian
there
car.
There was. It was like stepping into the middle of Turin. It was. But, and even I tried to say, true to tradition, I ordered a cappuccino, and it was in the morning.
It was
so it's okay.
Midday,
so
well done.
Okay.
I was going to say, yeah, we do have a bit of an issue here because clients come in, and obviously we have to look after our clients. And once in a while, you get someone that comes in the afternoon and they order a cappuccino.
How dare they?
And
oh dear.
I mean, to be honest, you
might want to show them out.
We do.
Yeah.
Like we do.
I don't care you were here to buy a LaFerrari. Get out of here.
We do. That's just, you know, I mean.
I believe you're looking for Romans International.
Yes, yes. They do great cappuccinos after 12. Pre-12, you want to be here. After 12, you want to go over there.
Love that. But you're right. There is a real Italian feel to this. And we had a little sneak peek at your... new phase of your next showroom. Is it a showroom or is that your kind of like collection area?
It's a good question. It's another showroom. I mean, it's another place for cars. You know, sort of in the next time you come, you'll go to the other side first.
Brilliant.
You'll have your cappuccinos before 12. If it's after 12, you have an espresso. If we're feeling in good mood, we might offer you a macchiato. or if you come in the evening, you'll have a Peroni.
Indeed.
It's like an advertising feature.
And if you ask for a cornetto here, you won't get an ice cream.
No.
Just to be clear.
He's really good. He's been practicing.
Yeah.
You'll have a look at some cars over there. And then once we've finished with the coffees and the first set of cars, then we'll bring you to the other side.
Perfect. But it's worth mentioning, so that room, that initial greeting room, is lined with marble that's been sourced from just outside Maranello.
Yeah, so we're just saying, yeah, there we go. So the tile, the marble comes from Italy. The tiles under the side come from just outside of Maranello. I mean, yeah, we're just trying, you know, support Italy here.
It is.
We like it.
And it is often said that Oxfordshire is the Tuscany of the UK. I don't know if you've ever heard that before, but looking out the window here, we could be in Tuscany. I can see an olive branch just out the window here, so, you know.
There isn't an old lady walking a load of goats around there. What's going on?
Not yet. No.
But when you walk out, you might someone arrive in a Panda 4x4.
That would just be the icing on the cake for me. If an elderly man with a big red nose pulled up in a Panda 4x4, at any point, the podcast is getting stopped and it's just going to test if I'm actually in reality or if this is a simulation, as we're all being told.
Well, we were speaking...
Sorry, can I make a quick phone call?
Yeah.
Of course.
Get the panda out. Get the panda out, guys. Quick.
Wheel out the panda.
Tell Dave to practice his Italian accent.
You wouldn't get that in Stratford upon Avon.
No.
We were speaking briefly about some of your exploits in Italy as well. And you mentioned Villa d'Este, which is an incredible event in Italy, around Lake Como area. You became quite a big part of that eventually, right?
Yeah, so I am... When did it start? I guess it started because 1 year they needed Simon Kitson, who's the compere, the MC. Back to Simon again, see your paths cross all the time. He had a graduation or he couldn't make the first day, so I was comparing instead of him. I do quite a lot of sort of comparing it at events, whether it's mainly Concours, as well as charity auctions. But yeah, recently I've just, which is great, I've sort of become judge at Villa d'Este. So now I go out every year and I have the pleasure, honour, responsibility of doing all the research before. It's actually a lot of work. You get all the details of the cars, you got to study them all before. You arrive there and you think, oh, this will be easy. No, you sit in a room with a head judge and then they go around like, right, what did you find out about all the cars? Like before you, so it's quite a big job and a big responsibility, but it's also an honor. Like it's, you know, Villa d'Este is one of the top concours of the world. It's got a lot of heritage. So to be asked to be a judge, I think is an honor. And it's a great satisfaction for me. They must obviously think I know a thing or two about cars. Surprisingly,
I think it's safe to say that you do by now. You know, I think you know a thing or two. Yeah, and exactly that. And just for a bit of context for the listener, we talk about Villa d'Este. It's actually the name of the hotel where it's hosted.
Correct.
Beautiful hotel, and it has quite a few stories itself, doesn't it? That you, but by all accounts, it was where Bernie Eccleston would broker a lot of his deals and all this kind of thing.
Right?
And
wow.
Yeah, so it's like what happens in the walls kind of thing. It's probably got a few stories to tell itself.
For sure. It's one of those typical sort of old Italian hotels built in the 30s, sort of actually pretty much unchanged.
Yeah.
You know, it's been there. And the Concours has been going on for I don't know, since the 1930s, 1940s. So, I mean, yeah, there is a lot of history there in times past and probably more recently as well.
Yeah,
you're right. I can imagine. So let's jump forward then to the daunting, scary, terrifying, exciting point that you decide, right, today's the day, handing in the notice, let's get cracking with this new business venture. It's something that I think the vast majority of us and many, many people listening to this will relate to as something they've either had a go at or they've aspired to do. But that, as you said before, there is no perfect day to start. There is no day in the calendar that you can build up to and go, right, that's going to be the day where everything's going to be fine. We can leave everything else behind and just crack on with this new business venture. Talk to me about the emotion and the thoughts behind getting your own business started and how much of it, as you see it now, as it's laid out or as it's continuing to develop into, represents that initial vision of what you thought it might turn into.
You know, I'd love to say to you like, oh yeah, yeah, I just decided, I handed in my notice and I just went for it. And the reality is it wasn't like that at all, because don't forget, I loved working at RM. I still speak to everyone there. Like some of my best friends are still there. I like speak to them every week. So it wasn't an easy like, oh yeah, I'm just gonna leave. But it was just time. I just well, as I said to you, my father passing away, I thought it was time. And when it came to thinking about it, I thought, you know, it's time. Why do you want to go? What do you want to do? And a couple of things for me that were important. It was less is more. So I wanted to deal with what I sort of touched upon it before: less cars, less people, and give more time to each car and each person. Like we hugely value relationships with our clients and. I don't want to say I'm not interested in having a client that transacts with us once, but we all said it was almost a failure. If someone buys a car and doesn't ever come back, then we've done something wrong. In the auction business, you get lots of people that pop in, pop out.
Sure.
It's exciting and you might buy one car never again or just, but here it's about having a relationship with the clients. And that was really, really important to me. So that was the first thing. And I think we have done that. We can always do better, of course, but I think we've done that really well. So we look after, we've got some really good clients now and we go all out and try and offer the idea is to offer the best possible service that you can get, because we got, you know, quite a lot of manpower and not very many clients. So we can do that. So that was one thing. But before that, it was also the choice, you know, you in this car world, there's lots of people that operate as a one-man band, super effective, very efficient. You know, you have your set of clients, you don't need this all big infrastructure. But certainly when I left, my thought was, I don't want to be by myself. I had a vision of a team and that we all go running together.
We did see on your Instagram.
Yeah,
did you?
No, but it was, for me, it was really, I have no interest in working on my own. It's just not what I wanted to do. I'd like to, I always had this vision of having a small, effective team where a bit sort of maybe where everyone gets along sometimes, most of the time.
We're looking nervously over at Alex.
Yeah,
now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I think we've, and it was never the vision to have like this massive, huge company. It was sort of, you know, you can go buy a suit from Hugo Boss and it's great quality and it's fantastic. Or you can go buy a suit from Savile Row and it's also great quality. And I tell you what, you know, I'll tell you the truth, probably the quality these days, you know, is probably actually similar, but it's a matter of which experience you want.
Yeah.
And maybe someone prefers to go to Armani because they've got all of them lined up, and someone wants to instead go to Savile Row and you probably get the same color suit and the same cut, but it's a different experience. So it's not that one is better than the other, but we want to give you, if you come here, the vision was to give you the Savile Row experience. So, and I think so far, we can always do better. Mm-hmm. But so far it's, we're sort of getting to that point where I think we really do give a good service to our clients, and we're really super proud of that.
Yeah.
You know, and we put a lot of effort into the cars. That's the great thing. We've got so much time to be able to, you know, at an auction, you've got 100 cars and you've got to sell them in one night.
Absolutely.
And you've got them on consignment for like 2 months, and but here we really have the time to like dig into these cars. And sometimes, like, you know, you get bad news as well. You think, oh Jesus, what did I do? Oh God, that was crashed. Oh, we didn't know we knew that. Well, then we just have to deal with it. But at least you don't get yourself into hot water. So it's a bit like Savile Row of the car world here.
Love that.
That's a great analogy. Yeah. And you know, and to your point, when we walked in, rightly so, there was a LaFerrari parked outside, ready to go to a customer in Netherlands, whatever. But as we walked in, there are cars that are what we consider to be super, super, super rare, but cars that are a little bit older, you know, etc. But they, each one absolutely has its own space. It's immaculately presented. Mm. Even a, you know, like the, is it a Group A Nissan? The R32.
Yeah.
Immaculately presented. Cars like that we expect to see, you know, maybe battered and all this kind of stuff. But excellent versions of the cars that you have here.
I mean, and I can bore you to death with the history files. We put every car that we have through here has like its own history file. We print up all the photos of the cars racing, or we speak to previous owners and get documentation. So we take a lot of pride in the amount of effort and energy that goes. But still, like for us, it's also about having some fun, you know. And I joked before, but I actually thought it was great. But us as a team yesterday, I think it was our best bit of the whole week. We all went out running. It's great. Like, because we do, at the end of the day, we work hard, but we also have to enjoy at the end of the day.
Of course.
You know? And if we have a good time doing this, then I think it passes on to the client. You know, right. I always say to the guys in the office, I don't know, take a car that's out there, a 458 GTE. Nobody needs a 458 GTE Le Mans car. Maybe lots of people want it, but nobody actually needs it. So if you're going to come here and spend 2 million euros on a 458 GT, you better be fun and you better have a good time. You got to get looked after. So that's the ethos. That's what we want to achieve. And so far, so good. If I can say so myself, or am I biased? I'm probably biased.
It seems to be working.
It seems to go all right.
Yeah, it seems
to go all right, yeah. Sorry, John, carry on.
That's all right. Yeah, so I want to explore then the challenge that can sometimes be a challenge, or maybe it's not. You can tell me. The task of consigning the cars here that you have, I'm guessing a lot are here sale or return, or the majority are here sale or return perhaps. How does that process compare to the good old days of consigning the cars at auction? Is it a similar practice? Do you get as much of a story, as much of a rapport with the seller, or I'm guessing maybe even slightly more?
Definitely a lot more. Because the sellers, you know, we try and keep them up to date every week, because it's not selling on a certain day. You know, we keep them updated every week. We try and let them know, we are always researching the cars. We found that Mura, we found some great photos that the seller had never seen of the car delivered to Turin at the airport next to the first owner's plane. I mean, how cool is that? So always keeping people in touch with what's happening. And you build a much, I wouldn't say it's a better relationship, but it's a different kind of relationship. And the process is slightly, it's also probably sometimes can be a lot quicker, sometimes can be a lot longer, but there isn't a defined point. Often in the auction world, you put your car at auction, if it's sold, great, you get the money, and then on to the next. If it's not sold, you get it back, and that's it. So here we can really tailor it and do our best to sort of, you know, make sure that we get, okay, it's not selling, so what do we have to do different, and how do we change it? You know, we don't give up very easily. And also, a lot of what we do, I mean, a huge amount of what we do is what we call sort of private sales. Mm-hmm. So cars that aren't never advertised, cars that, you know, people give us cars to sell that they don't necessarily want to be out in the public market, because we've got the network, we've got the contacts. Yep. And so actually, sort of almost annoyingly, because mm-hmm. we'd like to shout about it to everyone.
Of course.
You know, I mean, I don't know if you have to be careful to see what I say. In the last, whatever, 4 weeks, we sold a 2000 Ferrari Formula One car, a 3-podium Barrichello winner. We've sold a 250 LM. We've sold like some unbelievable cars. But however, people like to sometimes, some of our clients are very discreet. And that's why we offer sort of a different service. Often people say, oh, is it better? Do I go to auction or do I? Mm. It's two different things. Depends what car, depends what the situation is, depends what you want to achieve. And we also help people. You know, I've got plenty of experience buying and selling at auction, so you shouldn't be surprised if you see me up there bidding for a car for somebody or managing, helping someone, you know, sell a car. Like, I've done it long enough. I know what you can get, how to do it, and make sure that the auction, you get the best out of the auction house and best results.
Tell us a bit about, for me, who I've never bought a car at auction. It's something I would probably be, admittedly, be quite nervous about. What is the, I guess that's the difference with somebody like yourself or somebody like Gerardo and Co, where you come along and you provide all this information rather than going up and maybe having a flick of a few pages of something in a book. Maybe is that as far as it goes for some people when they're buying an auction?
Some people buy an auction and they just like put their hand up and think, oh,
what have I bought?
Did I buy it or did I not buy it? Oh, I was with a client on Monday and he was telling me a story how when I was still auctioneering and we were reminiscing how he was online bidding because he was in Australia. And he ended up buying a 1910 Minerva by accident because he wanted to buy the next lot, but he thought, oh God, let me. He's like, yeah, let me see if this online bidding. I'm registered. I just want to make sure it works. So he hit the enter button with a bid, and then he's like, and then it just went on for like 30 seconds, and then a minute, and then all of a sudden, he said to me, "You bugger, you said sold," and I thought, Jesus, that's not the one I wanted to buy. I was just practicing. I think that, I don't want to give away all the secrets, but with Monterey was in Monterey, we bought some cars for some clients, and hand on heart, was not to, I know the system, I know how it works. We saved our client on the most obvious example, on a $120,000 car. It was a small car that he wanted. We saved him at least $20,000. I promise you, if he would have gone there and bid himself and just done it all himself, not reading the room, you know, a bit of luck, but we were able to, because we were there, I was able to read the room, I knew exactly who was bidding, I knew exactly what the auctioneer was doing, like, it was, like, clear, black, like, I could, like, yeah, it was obvious.
That's
on a small car, but imagine on a $5 million car or a $10 million car, you know, of course, it's funny, it's a lot of money, you gotta know what you're doing, so that's where we can add value for our clients. So, really, for us, back to what we do is a little bit of try and offer like the complete service. Mm-hmm. There is no such thing as a complete service, but try and give as much advice as possible.
Yeah, I think that's the value there, isn't it? Because as you said, Miles, it is a daunting process, whether you're going in as a buyer or a seller. And I've had a couple of cars over the years where people have said, "Oh, we can get that in an auction for you." That's terrifying to me. So I'm like, but what if it sells for £1? it's obviously not going to happen. But that is terrifying. So knowing that there is somebody there that can walk you through it, talk you through it, be that almost hand-holding experience of, this is normal, don't worry about this.
This is what to do.
This is how we deal with it.
You know, and what will happen, like just a particular client with on Monday, you know, he's got 25 cars to sell. And I was like, right, we've decided. Like I said to him, I think, you know, these five or eight, I think we should put them in auction because of the value, because of the quality, because of it doesn't really make sense to in the grand scheme of things for his collection, what works for him, you know? And I said to him, I said, like, these other 12, I think that I'll do a lot better, you know, like auction fees are big. So you got to take everything into consideration. We'll do a lot better for you, you know, selling. I think, you know, it suits our clientele. I can think of people that would like the car and we can make sure they go to a good home. So it's just, you've got to give people the right advice.
Yeah.
Tell me. Now, there's a particular car that I want to talk to you about.
Let's go.
Which is I believe you were driving it at Goodwood earlier in the year. The 550 GT1 car.
Yes.
That for
Why do you want to go? Is that why you want to talk about it?
Oh my God. That is a car that has just, if there's a car that makes me stop in my tracks, wherever I just see it or hear it or see it start up, it's that. And there certainly aren't race cars like that anymore. You know, GT3 cars are all a bit of the same now, etc. But the GT1 cars were a totally different era of thing, particularly the Ferrari. And that V12 was just sounds marvellous.
Incredible noise.
It's unbelievable. I tell you, I'll go as far as say the best sounding GT1 car, bar none.
Oh, yeah.
I'm happy to put it back there. We'll see some comments afterwards, see if anyone can outdo me on this. But there is no better sounding. That V12, when it's screaming down the Morzan Strait, is absolutely unbelievable. I was really lucky. I drove it at Le Mans before the 24-hour race last year. There was a pre-race or a for GT1 cars and LMP1 cars of that era. And as part of that, we got pit passes. It's amazing. The amount of mechanics and people and drivers that came out and said, oh my God, what has happened to Le Mans? What has happened to our race cars? Why don't they sound like that? Like, I've never seen so many of the teams. Of course, everyone's on the grandstands, but the team members and the drivers out there listening, they just wanted to hear it. They just wanted to hear it. Is absolutely phenomenal. And then to bring it back to Le Mans, where, you know, I mean, a 551 won its class at Le Mans, was on pole position at Le Mans. That our car was driven by Colin McRae and Darren Turner at Le Mans. For a car guy to be, you think, is this possible? Yeah. I'm at Le Mans in a 550 Pro Drive, and I'm actually in the proper circuit with hundreds of thousands of people watching because it was before the 24-hour race. I mean, what an experience. If you, even if you don't like cars, that must be amazing. My wife said to me, that's pretty cool, right? I was like, yeah.
It's in the diary. It's in the diary. Yeah. Chalk it down. It's a car that's just, as you say, you know, the attention it attracts. It looks magnificent. You know, it looks like a proper race car. Sounds like a proper race car. And I would encourage, I think there's an onboard, a very short onboard of you driving it. And it's just a few laps of the Goodwood circuit.
Yeah.
And I could watch that time and time and time again.
It's still manual sequential.
Yeah.
So you know, I love that feeling that you got to tug on that gear shift because you're moving the cogs.
Yeah.
It's not like a little flick of a paddle and then there's some computer and hydraulics and you are the one that is going to move from the cog from second to third. And on the way down, it's quite busy. You're sort of on the way going down through the gearbox into the corner. You know, you've got a brake. You got to put the clutch down to save the gearbox, down the gear, blip the throttle to rev match. You're actually, as crazy as it sounds, you're actually quite busy, but it's fun. And when you get it right, you feel like the king of the world.
I mean, it is.
And when you get it wrong, you think, oh my God, it's going to be expensive. But but it is an amazing, amazing experience. Really amazing.
You've both mentioned a couple of key things when talking about that car, which have brought back some memories of me. So I'm guessing this was the parade at the members' meeting beginning of the year.
Yes, that's right.
When it went past. And it just so happened that I was standing there, one of the evening parades. It was just as the sun was going down. It was all looking very romantic and beautiful. And I was there with a very close friend of mine, Tim Hutton. We were talking about Tim, Alex, and I just before we started recording. And Tim and I were standing there, and we both made the same remark, which is, isn't it amazing how different all the cars sound? And of course, you go to a modern-day Le Mans, you go to a modern-day, even just a GT race, or everything sounds so similar. Everything is a 6 or 8 cylinder turbocharged engine. They all make a farty noise as they drive past. The collection of noises that went past in that parade were just amazing, because you had everything from the old Corvettes rumbling along. The scream of the V12 sounded incredible. It is a theatre that we don't see anymore, sadly, because, of course, everything is now about what's the most efficient, what's going to go the fastest. Oh, but they all sound the same. Ah, but that's just how it is.
And, you know, coming back to you know, we own that car, and that's something that has sort of no price, and that we decided that we thought it was a great thing to own because financially it was going to only appreciate. We've got a good handle of the market. There was now the racing for it. It's a very satisfying car to drive. It's the right brand. There's a whole number of reasons. And actually, something that we sort of do now or can do now is that we have some clients and they do want to get involved and say, like, what should I buy? And it's not so much, you know, comparing again to the auction world where you should buy whatever's next for sale. Whereas since we've got more time and a little bit like we did with the Subarus, like, you know, I've got a Subaru and we believe in them. We organize the sort of our clients go out. Lots of our clients have bought them. Everyone's done really well out of them. Everyone's had a good time. So that's something really like for our good clients. We don't hesitate to call up and say, right, I really think this would be a good car for your collection. I think the price is right. We've done all the research. And so you have with us, I think not necessarily everyone that walks off the street and says, "Hi, what should I buy?" But once you're a client of ours, I think that's one of the things that you really give them is advice on what to do going forward.
Sure.
Not just like being reactive as to what do I have for sale and what should we sell. You know, there's a lot of like, you know, we're just in the middle of selling a really big Ferrari, and it really makes sense for this client in his collection because I know what he likes. I know what, and he's like, "Yeah, I just thought you're right. I really should have it." And that's something that's also really satisfying that people probably don't see from the outside world, but we do really a lot of. Is it not really curating collections, but just trying to give the advice to people to write, this is, I think, what to do, and to make sure that it's the right car, it's the right money, that you're not going to, you know, lose on it. I'm not saying we're not here to make people, ensure that people make money, but if you get the right advice, people are investing millions, many, many millions. I mean, talking 10, 15, yeah. You know, so it's big decisions.
Yeah, completely. Do you have cars that if an inquiry comes in or there might be a message left and this is Mr. Smith and he has a insert car here, is there certain things that still really get you excited, or are there certain models that you haven't had yet that if that phone call came in, is there one car in particular that you think, my God, I'd love to sell a?
You know, I mean, listen, I always get a little bit excited when there's an Italian car, Italian car involved, and I've been super lucky. Most people say that everyone would like to sell a GTO or be involved in the sale of a GTO once in their life. I've been really lucky that I've auctioned one. I've also sold one privately as well. I spent a lot of time driving one, so I have to say I have been so lucky that not only I've been involved with so many different cars, you know, all the cars that are like, I can't say that there is one that I haven't sold yet. Maybe one day, you know what, I've auctioned one, but I'd like to rehome or find the best 250 Testarossa. I think that's something that I you know what, I do that. I would, someone calls, unfortunately, not very often that someone just calls, "Hi, I've got a 250 Testarossa like to sell."
I mean, I've got a lovely 1/10 scale of one at home. If that gets you on your way, start. I'm happy to hand it over.
Building blocks. So where do the majority of your inquiries come from and cars come from? Is it word of mouth? Is it people that have just known you over the years through the auction
Thanks to
world?
The most amazing marketing and Instagram that Alex does for our company.
He's blushing. He's blushing.
The brochures that we do, the email blast that we do.
Yeah.
It's a combination. So there's almost like two sides to the business. There is one side which is inquiries that people see. Social media is we try and give a flavor of what we do, what happens behind the scenes. Our website, our e-blast, that's sort of one side of the business. And then the other side of the business is, oh God, how long has it been? I don't know, 25 years of working with cars and relationships. I mean, some of our, not to disappoint Alex, but some of our best clients, I don't think they even know we have a website, or they don't even look at our website.
Yeah.
It's more of right, Max, what are we going to do? What should we buy? What should we sell? Where are we? What's next? Or what do you think I should do? So there is it's a combination of both.
It's a stark contrast though, isn't it? And I've discovered this in talking to a few other people that have made a business from buying and selling cars, and the amount that can happen through social media, and the idea that there's somebody somewhere, let's romanticize it by saying that they're on a yacht docked in Portofino Harbour, and they're having a look through their Instagram reel, and they're scrolling down, and oh, there's a car that's popped up from their suggested for you page, and it happens to be something they've always wanted, and oh look, it's for sale with Gerardo. That can lead to an inquiry, that can lead to a sale. Just think that can happen just from somebody opening up Instagram. If you'd have questioned that 15, 20 years ago, you'd have been laughed out of the room, wouldn't you? The idea that somebody might see a photo of something on their phone and go, oh, I wonder if it's for sale. Oh, it is. Okay, cool. I'll make a call, put a deposit down, and then buy it.
It's unbelievable, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like the way technology has changed our business. I mean, I love talking to the old boys, and they're like, oh, you know, I used to go and get, you know, Auto Trader magazine or whatever it is, Trademark or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, and I used to go and try and get, be the first one to get it so I could flick through and see if there was any E-types, and I'd be the first one to call. And you know, David Cottingham always tells from DK, tells the good story about like how he'd go and buy all the XK120s, but he'd go to the printers to get it before it went out to everyone, he could call people a day before the magazine actually comes out.
That's
and you know what? as crazy as it sounds, it's sort of the same now.
Yeah.
Like, you know, people want to know before. And quite often, you know, we'll call clients and say, look, we've got this coming. It makes sense for you. And I think people really value that. You know, you get offered the car, offered the opportunity to buy certain cars before it goes to market. Except now it's not the classified magazines.
Yeah. I love the idea of that. Sneaking into the printers and going, oh, can I just proofread that, please? Then quick, running to a payphone.
Write down the phone number. Payphone, five over.
Yeah, exactly.
Leave a deposit.
So, Max, give us a bit of a flavour of the Girardeau perspective, if you will, for maybe what this looks like for maybe the next, you know, 5 or 10 years. Because, as you say, people invest in them as they do now. They're not just investing in stocks, they're investing in assets, particularly cars.
Yep.
But they're obviously the people that are buying them because they want the cars.
You know, guys, like the most, and I say this so often, the most important thing, the thing that keeps our business alive, the best thing, we are so lucky. Let me give you a practical example before I tell you what it is. If you invested, pick a number, 100, a million pounds in stocks, and I called you, and I was a stockbroker, I don't know anything about stocks, disclaimer, and I called you and I said, your stocks are going to go down by 5% overnight because of this announcement. Mm. So, you know, what do you want to do? And then you can buy them back again tomorrow, hopefully. Sell them today at full price and hopefully buy them tomorrow for 5% less. You'd probably be like, great, sold, gone, finished. If you were the same conversation and I said, you know, your Ferrari 275, which is like £2 million, is going to go down by 10% because there's going to be an announcement of a recall. I tell you what, I will stick my neck out. 90% of my clients will say, yeah, that's great. It's my 275. Mm. I don't want another one.
Love that.
They're not. It's my car. I've restored it, or I've owned it for 15 years, or yeah. But it's the one that was, you know, delivered new to my hometown, or it's the one that I remember. So our world is, yes, people buy them for investment, and everyone wants to make money, and it's great. Feels great, right? You buy a car for £100,000, and oh, good, look, it's worth 100. By the end of the day, it's passion that drives it all, and that keeps the market so strong. You know, look at Goodwood. No one's there to you know, invest. They're all there to use the cars because they love them. And the passion that we have in our world is phenomenal. And I think most people undervalue how important it is to the classic car world.
Yeah.
Hugely, yeah. And we had some fascinating conversations. Well, obviously you yourself as well at Revival. We spoke to the likes of Peter James, who was racing the Mark 1 Jaguar in the St. Mary's. And the story with that was he had, as a kid, basically seen a red Mark 1.
Yeah.
And had always dreamed of driving one, racing one at Goodwood. And sure enough, the car was built, and there it was. He was doing that just to live out basically a childhood dream. Mm-hmm. And then another inside story was that him and Theopithetis always would race, basically they wanted to race together, and whoever would lose would have to buy a magnum of champagne in London. And it turns out Peter James just chipped him on this one. So the bill's on Theo this time. But there were some fascinating origin stories like that. Yeah. People, it wasn't just, oh, you know, I've heard Goodwood was a good event, so I'm going to turn up. Mm. They've wanted to do this for tens of years.
And isn't it great?
Yeah. I love that.
That is great. And I think, you know, we talk about the market and we talk about where the prices are going. And listen, there's always fluctuations in the market. Not all the cars are going to go up forever. Things will change. You know, fashion changes, generational change. Everyone talks about, you know, generational change and like the modern cars. Well, see, I've been in this business too long. You know, I always think, to me, an F40 is still like a modern car.
Yeah.
Alex is much younger. He's like, no, that's an old thing, right? The modern cars are doing particularly well because it's what the new generation remembers. Yes, there's always going to be changes, but the main thing is that what nobody ever talks about is the passion. And because of the passion, people aren't always going to just sell for make more money, or people aren't going to sell if the market goes down. You know, take me. I mean, I'm in the business, and you could tell me that it's funny, actually. You could tell me that my Alfa Romeo Z is going to go down to like one. I know it's not really realistic. Go down to £1.
Yeah.
And would I sell it? No. But the flip side, I had a client in here on Saturday, actually the owner of the 300SL AMG that we talked about.
Yeah.
And he said to me, I told him the story of the SZ. He's like, that's amazing. He said, tell me something, Max. Would you ever sell it? I said, no. And he said, what did you pay? I said, oh, it was about whatever, 100,000 euros. He goes, if I wrote you a check now for 200, you sell it? I was like, no. Would you sell it if I wrote you a check now for 500,000? I was like, no, it's my car. I was like, what about a million? I was like, that's a lot of money. But no. But that shows like...
Show me the money.
Yeah, show me the money.
Is that a wire like now? But you know, that does... The passion makes a huge difference to our market. And thanks to this passion, thanks to Goodwood and the Mille Miglia and Villa d'Este, I think that our market is sort of super healthy. Like there's so many people that want to do so many things and so many experiences with these cars. However, you know, not everything's going to keep on going up. And as I say to all my clients time and time again, buy the car because you love it.
Yeah.
Buy it because you're going to use it. Buy it because it's what you always wanted. Buy it because it completes your set, whatever your personal reason is. But please, please, please don't buy it because you think you're going to make money. Like that shouldn't be, don't make me wrong. You want to buy it well, you don't want to waste money.
Yeah, of course.
But your main objective should not be buy it because I want to make money.
Absolutely. It's like artwork on the wall. It's something I've dabbled in a little bit over the years with artwork, and it's always the same rule of thumb. Are you buying that work of art because you can picture it looking great in a particular part of the house, or are you buying that because you're hoping that in 10 years' time it might be worth five times what you spent?
Because you know what happens? If you buy it because you think it looks great on your wall, yeah, and then someone, a bit like Maya said, someone comes along and says, and you paid £10 for it, someone says, oh, I'll give you 15, and you think, but it looks so good. I don't want to sell. And so you know what happens? Then you end up making much more money than you think.
Yes.
Because you don't sell it because you love it unless someone gives you a crazy, crazy amount of money.
100%.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's
it. My smaller version of that was the M5 that I own. I was still working at Bentley Motors at the time. And again, I was like earning decent money. I was like sort of 25. How old have I been? 24. I've had it 5 years now. And I had a little bit of cash, but not much. I thought, well, what do I buy? I had like sort of £10,000. And what do you buy? Buy a hot hatch, or do you buy? do you put it towards finance or something else? I didn't want to do that. And I'm thinking around, what was it? And the story of the M5 was that my dad, at one point, he was a financial advisor, and then obviously when I had a bit of a cold last week. Market crash, he didn't do that job anymore, and he went to go and deliver cars for Sittners and Greypool. So they would go and buy cars, obviously, off clients, put them in the showroom. One of them was an E39 M5, uh-huh. And he picked me up from school in it. And I remember thinking, looking at it, going, well, it's just a 5 Series BMW, you know, like, what more do you say? And he started it up, and I was like, oh. This is quite different.
Sounds special.
Quite special. And we went for, I remember vividly going for a drive down to Bardell's Island in Nottingham and thinking, this thing is unbelievable. And then when you hit the brakes, I went, oh no. Oh dear. It's a BMW M5. Anyway, and that was how I sort of learned about the car. And there was a guy who was selling one, and he wanted £12,000 for it at the time. I was like, I just don't have that much money. Anyway, 2 years later, he was really needing to buy a house, and he went, I really need to sell the car. I went, this is good timing.
£8,000 I'll give you now.
So I gave him £9,500. So I think I was doing quite well with it, and I got a brand new set of Michelin Pilot Sport 4s with it. He's thinking, okay, we're doing all right here. Anyway, I bought the car just simply because of that story, and I just really, really wanted one, and they happened to be very, very cheap at the time. Mm. Now they're not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But still, you know, I have been offered good money for it in the past, and I do not want to sell it. It's painful at times because, you know, things go wrong. It's a 2000 car, it's 20 years old now. But there's not really a lot that would push me over to the edge to the moment where I go, do you know what, let's move it on.
So the passion is what drives our business, what keeps the values where they are. I can't ever see a crash. It's actually quite a safe place to have some money because I can't ever see a crash in the market because the passion is not going to go out from one day to the next. I've even got clients to say to me, God, we'd like there to be a crash because then I'll buy all the cars up again.
Yeah.
But that just shows to you that if the prices go down, I can list you a whole bunch of clients that will want to buy a Daytona or a Miura or because we're like, oh, that's good value, you know? So passion.
It's
passion
true. It's the one thing. I think if there was a strap line to this podcast or even just Driven in general, it would be that we are so lucky. And I've said this time and time again, anyone that's listened to every single one of our episodes is probably going to know the script of what I'm about to say. But it's the fact that we are so lucky that the industry we're in is passion led. We're all in it, whether we're in it to sell cars or buy cars or service cars or arrange cars, logistics. We're in this industry because we love cars. And that is so unique. That is so unusual. There are very few other industries that we can work in and pursue a career in where everybody else in it is there because they're passionate about the product. You might see it a little bit with fashion. You might see it, I guess, a little bit in equestrian activities, if that's the kind of thing you're into. But otherwise, anything else we're doing in life, it's just a job that happens to have a particular focus. Mm-hmm. But with us and our world, we're so lucky because we're here simply because we love cars. The three of us are sat in this room right now for no other reason, really, than the fact that we like cars.
Exactly.
And that's I came for the coffee, to be honest.
Yeah, it's a really special thing. So before we start to wrap things up then, I'd like to, and I know it's an impossible question to answer, especially quickly and easily, but we are looking at an ever-changing world of automotive, especially with new cars. You know, we're working towards deadlines, albeit flexible deadlines, as we've recently discovered, but deadlines where we're no longer going to be able to go and buy a car powered by petrol or diesel. That, to a huge number of people, is a really vital factor to what makes a car special. It's the bit that comes to life. It's the bit that sounds good and smells good and gives a real atmosphere to the experience of driving. What is your future vision? You know, thinking about the kids, for example, who might pursue and go, right, that's it, Dad, we're going to take over this business from here on. 30, 40 years from now, what do you think that car world's going to look like? And are the cars that you've currently got sat in the cattle shed, as I keep calling it, are they still going to be as special as they are now? Do you think the next generation of drivers will appreciate those cars in the same way that we do?
Look, you know, actually, I think that they'll probably appreciate them even more. Today, we're all worried, probably us that love car lovers, up in arms, oh, electrification or whatever, whichever route we're going down. But, you know, I always give the example of the turn of the century, you know, not that everyone remembers, I was going to say, cast your mind back. You know, 1900s, there was everyone could afford it, to get around would walk or go on a horse, right? Horseback was, I don't know, I watch lots of Western movies and the cowboys seem to arrive on horses and they tie them up outside the pubs and go in for a pint. And then at some point, somebody came up with his invention, which was a car. Yeah. And I bet you, there wasn't podcasts at the time, but there was probably three guys in a pub thinking, God, what's going to happen to our horses?
Yeah.
It's going to be over. This new thing, this car thing, it's all like, there's not going to be water troughs outside of pubs anymore. Where are we going to like water our horses and so on? And, you know, and the car then came in, it sort of took over, if you like. But think about it now. Think about the horses now. And, you know, you mentioned horses before. The amount of horse racing there is,
yeah,
the amount of horse rides that there are, the industry is still thriving. And I'll go further and say, maybe they're even more special than they were 100 years ago, because it used to be a thing that you would just have to move from point A to point B. I'm sure there was probably racing as well, and there was. But now it's it's a huge, huge, huge industry passion-led world of horse riding. And I, you know what? I think the cars might follow a similar suit. And maybe you're right. You are not gonna no longer, you know, if you need to move from A to B, you will probably no longer use a petrol engine. That's probably finished. It's gonna be an electric car. I don't know if electrification is gonna be 100% the way forward. And it sort of kind of makes sense. But when it comes to do a race, when it comes to do Goodwood, when it comes to do an event, a rally, a tour, I think that these cars with petrol engines will definitely be around for ever and ever and ever. And they might even become more special because all of the little ones, you won't be able to, you know, very few people go to, I don't see anyone taking any kids to school on horseback anymore. And it'll be the same thing. So I think the future is definitely, definitely there. There'll be, I've also heard, there's not going to be any more fuel. Yeah, it seems like synthetic fuels are definitely making great, you know, great progress, and it seems like, I mean, there was the Bentley boys from Medcalf. They ran all their Bentleys on synthetic fuels at Goodwood.
Absolutely,
fantastic.
Yeah.
So there is a solution for the fuel, and the cars will be used. You're right. You're not going to take a petrol car to go from A to B. And I was at a great talk by Mate. What's the name of the guy that owns Rimac?
Yeah, Mate.
Mate Rimac. Yeah, you're right. And I went to an event in St. Moritz, and he came in his latest Bugatti. Obviously, they own somehow Bugatti, right? And someone in the panel said, you know, sort of question answer, like, oh, is Bugatti going to go electric? And what's going to happen? You know, you're in Rimac, you're in Bugatti. He's like, no, Bugatti's not going to go electric right now. But he said, make no mistake, electrification is happening. Mm-hmm. That is happening. However, fun cars will remain with petrol engines, and we will still use them. And I thought that was actually very telling and very smart for him to say.
Yeah.
So am I worried for them? Sorry, long explanation. Quick answer, no, not at all. Perfect. They're going to become even more valuable and even more special.
Well, I'm going to sleep easier tonight.
But next time you come here, you might have to come in an electric car. But that's because it's, you know, A to B and you just have to move your kit. Yeah,
I can assure you that won't be happening.
Mars is probably the most dead set person I know who is just not going to find himself in an EV anytime soon.
No, that's for sure.
But that was a beautiful answer, because I think it's the kind of thing that people really need to hear, want to hear. And it's true. I think you're absolutely spot on. I think there is this almost bizarre hysteria with a lot of people that seem to think that the man is going to come and take away our car and take away our fuel and we'll have nowhere to fill them up. But that just isn't the case. You know, there's bizarrely a new housing development that I live on at the moment. They're building a petrol station at the end of the road. Can you believe that?
A one, two, three.
And it's just like, you know, somebody told me, oh, they're building a petrol station at the end of the road. And I was like, well, surely you mean an EV charging, but no, it's an actual petrol station. These cars aren't going anywhere, and for many, many years there's going to be a huge overlap of even the day-to-day stuff, let's be honest. Mainly because Miles is just not going to give up. There'll be one last 320D driving around and it'll be Miles.
This is such an exciting diesel car as well. I mean, if it was an Audi R18 diesel, I think okay, you know, but the last gallon of diesel is going to go in a 320D. I'm a little bit sad, actually.
But it'll be driven very well. Let's say that. But yes, you're right. I think that is a really wonderful thing to hear, and perhaps even a perfect way to end. That you're pointing out that the future isn't as tragic and as upsetting and as terrible as a lot of us are being led to believe.
It's actually great. They're going to be more special.
Exactly. Oh,
it's going to be even better.
Yeah, leave the fuel, leave the crude oil-based fuel for the stuff that really needs it.
And exactly.
Your Vauxhall Zafiras and your Vauxhall Courses, and I'm really attacking Vauxhall here, as I frequently do.
Sorry, Vauxhall owners. If you like a Zafira, it's fine.
Nobody driving Vauxhall listens to this podcast. Okay. I don't mean that. I'm sorry, everyone that drives a Vauxhall. But yeah, you know, the kind of generic cars that we are using for our day-to-day stuff, as you say, they're going to become obsolete. Therefore, the fuel is saved for the stuff that really matters and the stuff that does come to life and put a big smile on our faces and makes a big difference. For some people, that might be a Vauxhall. Fair play to you. You crack on. For now, though, I think we'll probably wrap up, if that's okay. It's been absolutely wonderful to have this opportunity, as we said. We didn't even reference the fact that we talked about this initially at the Goodwood Revival, which was only few weeks ago. But yeah, we were chasing you around an assembly area with a handheld microphone, so it's quite nice to be sat down a bit more relaxed in slightly more comfortable clothing. And yeah, really great to see this amazing facility, hear your amazing story, and you know, it feels almost cliche to sign off and go, we wish you all the best for the future. We know it's going to be amazing. We know that the future is going to be incredible. So just keep doing what you do.
Listen, you'll have to come back and check in on us and see if it's going going well, and then we can also check in on what's happening with electrification and 320Ds.
See if Miles has got himself an EV.
No.
For now, I will say thank you so much for listening. As ever, we really appreciate any minutes you give to us. If you've made it this far, then you've made it to the end, and that is incredible for us. So a huge thank you. We will include the links in our show notes below. You'll be able to see all the details of Gerardo & Co, including some links through to the social feeds. If you're not already following, it's probably a very good time to do so. There are some amazing photographs to enjoy there, mainly thanks to Alex over there, who's sitting in the corner very sheepishly keeping his head down. But thank you, Alex, for all that. And of course, don't forget, you can see everything that we do on our website, driven.site. Head over to the website. You can see the entire back catalogue of podcasts there, as well as all the written articles we do, the videos that we produce, photographs that we take, and just general news stories that we like to show each and every day. So thank you so much for listening. Miles, thank you as ever.
Thank you very much.
Max, a very sincere thank you very much.
Pleasure to have you guys here.
Grazie mille.
Ah, anche lui parla italiano.
Hey,
just keeping it quiet the whole time.
That's it.
See if it got brought up.
Is that all you took away from your week in coma?
See.
And a lot of Aperol spritz.
Yeah, too much of that. Yes, thank you so much for listening. Thank you both. And we look forward to bringing you more of the same in about 7 days' time. Goodbye.
The Driven Chat Podcast, powered by Paramex Digital.
Oh, wow, you've made it to the end, the very end. And it's John Markar here again, reminding you that this podcast, the Driven Chat Podcast, has now run its course and has come to an end. To find the new format, search the Driven Podcast in your preferred podcast app, or head on over to the website, driven.site, to find some quick and easy links through to the new episodes in the new formats
on your preferred apps. Thanks. Bye.